This is tape number two on Aristotle. Aristotle's views about the mind and its relationship to the body are scattered throughout his works. But he most systematically discusses the mind and body in a work called Peripsyches. Translators have traditionally rendered this into English as On the Soul. But in spite of its widespread usage, this translation of the title is misleading. First, the English word soul has a spiritual connotation which is not shared by the Greek word psyche. Second, psyche generally has a much broader meaning than the term mind. Aristotle took for granted, as did virtually all other Greek thinkers of antiquity, that the psyche is what makes every living thing, plants and animals alike, alive. Nevertheless, in our discussion of Aristotle's philosophy of mind, we will follow tradition, mostly at least, and translate the Greek psyche as soul. But we should keep in mind that what Aristotle is concerned with here is understanding both what the mind is and what makes a living thing alive. We must also remember that these issues are at the heart of controversies that continue to the present day, as medical technology brings about ever more complicated problems related to the beginning and the ending of life. Plato, Aristotle's mentor, had maintained that the soul and the body are altogether different kinds of substances. Plato believed the soul, unlike the perishable body, is immortal. A body is alive, Plato thought, only when inhabited by a soul. He believed that when a soul leaves its body, it transmigrates to the underworld to be judged. The good make the journey to heaven, where they enjoy unspeakable bliss. The evil are cast into hell, where they pay mightily for their past sins. Plato describes the otherworldly punishments of the wicked in the Republic.
If anyone had been the cause of many deaths, or had betrayed his own city and army and sent them into slavery, or had done injustice of any kind, this would be his punishment. They should receive in payment pain, 10 times the pain of each of the wrongs they had caused.
When the penalty's been paid, Plato believed the soul chooses yet another body to inhabit, even the body of a completely different species. The soul of a human, therefore, could enter the body of a bird or a lion. Plato described some of these choices at the end of the Republic.
The soul of Orpheus chose the life of a swan because he hated women, since he had been killed by them, and thus was unwilling to be born of a woman. The soul of Agamemnon, because he hated the human race, chose the body of an eagle. The soul of the fool Thersites wrapped itself in the body of an ape. And in a like manner, beasts entered into the bodies of men and into one another. Unjust men entered the bodies of wild beasts, while the just entered the bodies of tame creatures. And there was every kind of mixture and combination.
But for Aristotle, any idea that the soul passes from one body to another simply misunderstands what the soul is. In the following passage, he almost certainly is criticizing the Platonic concept of an immortal soul.
There is an absurdity in this account of the soul, and with most others. Those who think this associate and place the soul in the body without defining why this is so. These people only try to say what the nature of the soul is, but they specify nothing about the body receiving the soul, as if it were possible for any soul whatever to enter into any body whatever. For just as each craft uses tools, the soul uses the body.
A soul, then, according to Aristotle, requires not just a body, but a particular kind of body that can do particular things. A human soul requires a human body. A canine soul requires a dog's body. But if the soul can't exist after death, how should we understand what the soul is? The modern student of Aristotle will no doubt be puzzled by this definition of the soul. Aristotle begins to define the term as the essence of the body.
Of natural bodies, some have life and some do not. We say that something is living because it takes in nourishment, grows, and decays. Thus, Every natural body is a substance, and a substance is a compound. If something is a body of a definite sort, since it has life, the body is not a soul, since the body is a substratum and matter. It is necessary, therefore, that the soul be a substance, but only in the sense that it is the essence of a body which has the power of living. But substance in this sense is actuality.
As the end of the passage makes clear, Aristotle thinks that the soul is the essence of a living body. But to understand this notion, we need to review briefly several of the key doctrines developed in Aristotle's work, Metaphysics. First, every natural substance is a compound of two things: matter, the material making up the substance, and form, the organization of matter that makes it a definite kind of thing. The form of a substance is also its essence, and this essence enables a substance to perform its characteristic functions. If a substance lost its characteristic powers, for example, if a living being died, it would no longer possess this essence. It would no longer be the kind of thing it had been before those powers were lost.
If the eye were a living creature, its soul would be vision, for this is the essence of the eye. The eye is the matter of vision. If vision fails, there is no eye, except in name only, as, for instance, a painted eye is an eye in name only.
But Aristotle thinks that this definition of the soul as the essence of a living body is ambiguous, incomplete.
It is ambiguous, just as knowledge is ambiguous, since it could mean, on the one hand, the possession of knowledge, or it could mean the actual employment of knowledge. Both sleep and waking require a soul, and being awake is analogous to the actual employment of knowledge. Sleep to the mere possession of knowledge, but not its exercise. In the same person, the possession of knowledge comes first. Thus, the soul is the first actuality of a natural body possessing the potential to be alive, and this will be a body possessing organs.
Aristotle relies here on the distinction between possessing something and using it. He claims that a living body possesses certain powers, but doesn't necessarily use them. So even if rationality is part of the essence of human beings, we have souls even when we don't think rationally. To have a human soul, we need only have the power, the potential, to act rationally. Now we can see more clearly why Aristotle claims that the soul can't exist without the body. He says the soul and the body are really two necessary aspects of the same thing. He illustrates his point with a famous analogy between the soul and a seal imprinted on a piece of wax.
We need no more inquire whether the soul and the body are one than whether a piece of wax and the imprint upon it are the same.
So the living body can't be separated from its soul, its power to function. Aristotle says there are as many different kinds of souls as there are species of living things. Indeed, Aristotle meticulously cataloged different species. And this suggested to him that there's a virtually infinite variety of species, ranging from the simplest sea plants to the most complex of the animals, man.
Nature stretches continuously from the lifeless to animals, and in the continuum there are living things which are not quite animals. The result is that the class of plants is so close to the other class, the class of animals, that there appears to be only an infinitely small difference between the two.
Aristotle believed that this infinite variety of souls can be grouped into three basic categories based on different kinds of functions. The most basic functions characteristic of all living substances are: one, to assimilate food; two, to increase and then decrease in size; and three, eventually to pass out of existence through decay.
It is by living that what has a psyche is to be distinguished from what does not have a psyche. But since the word living is used in many ways. We say that a thing is alive if any one of the following is present in it. For example, thought, sensation, movement and rest in space, change brought about by nutrition, and decay and increase in size. Hence all plants are alive, for they have in them the capacity by which they grow and then decay. For they do not grow up and not down, but both up and down and in every direction, and take in nutrition, and continue to live as long as they have the power to take in food. This power may exist apart from the other capacities, but it is not possible among living beings for the other capacities to exist apart from this one. This is made clear among plants, for they possess no other power of the psyche.
According to Aristotle, a plant's power to perform these elemental functions comes from what he calls the nutritive soul. Animals obviously can perform more complicated functions than plants can. Aristotle says this is true because animals have a sensitive psyche. They experience things through the power of sensation. But Aristotle says anything that has senses must also have desire.
All animals have at least one of the senses, namely, touch. And any organism in which touch resides also experiences pleasure and pain. But desire resides in those organisms which experience pleasure and pain. For desire is an appetite for the pleasant.
Perception enables an animal to find the things that sustain its life. But in order for perception to be effective, the animal must also be motivated to attain those things. And this motive power is desire. Desires are always desires for something. So it would be useless for animals to have desire and yet not be able to seek what they want. Aristotle says sensation is an organism's power to actually pick out desired objects in its environment. The third type of psyche is what Aristotle calls the rational soul. This soul enables humans to act rationally, although they also have the powers of the nutritive and sensitive psyches. Rationality is the power to grasp abstractions, to grasp what Aristotle sometimes calls universals, including essences. Mere sensation, by contrast, allows us to perceive only an object's particular characteristics, which he calls sensible forms. For instance, we use our sense of sight to perceive that one thing is white and another is black. But when we grasp that both of these perceived objects are horses, we're employing our rational faculty. We're grasping that the two objects share the same essential characteristics. Aristotle distinguishes between sensation and reason as follows.
They differ in that with sensation, what causes the sensation comes from the outside, that is, from what is seen or heard. And similarly, for the other objects of sensation. This is because the actual sensation is of particulars, whereas thinking is always of universals. Such powers, in a sense, reside in the same soul. But it lies in a person's power to use his rationality whenever he wishes. But it is not within his power to sense whenever he wishes, for the object of sensation has to be present.
Aristotle clearly believes that sensation and thought are different processes, but he doesn't clearly describe how these two functions are to be understood. Let's consider first what he tells us about sensation.
It is necessary to grasp in a general way what is true of all perception, namely, that sensation is the reception of the sensible forms without the matter. As, for example, wax is receptive of the imprint of the signet ring without being receptive of the iron or the gold or bronze of the ring. Similarly, each sense organ is affected by what has color or flavor or sound, but without reference to what it is, but by its having a particular quality and a particular formula. The sense organ is, in its primary sense, that in which this power to receive the sensible form of an object is to be found. Therefore, the sense organ and the potentiality are the same thing, but they do not have the same essence. What does the perceiving must be corporeal, but sensation is not something corporeal. Rather, sensation is a ratio and power of the sense organ.
Aristotle's introduced the notion of sensible form to distinguish sense perception from thinking. We perceive a sensible form, but we think about an abstraction. Aristotle explains this.
I mean by a particular object of a sense that which cannot be perceived by any other sense, and concerning which it is not possible to be in error. For example, sight is concerned with color, hearing with sound, taste with flavor, but touch has many different objects it senses. Each sense judges what is proper to it, and is not mistaken about what it senses, color for seeing or sound for hearing, but only about the nature or position of what is seen or heard.
Every sensible form lies somewhere on a continuum bounded by two extremes: white and black colors, dull and sharp sounds, sweet and bitter flavors, so forth. Moreover, each particular object of sense can be expressed as a ratio of the one extreme to the other. Aristotle says a particular color, blue, for example, is a ratio of so much whiteness to so much blackness. Red is a different ratio of white to black. So Aristotle asserts that when a sense organ senses something, it receives the sensible form without the matter. The perceived object somehow changes the material of the sense organ. But the eye, for example, doesn't directly contact what it sees. So Aristotle maintains that the perceived object must first cause a change in some medium between the sensible form and the sense organ. Here's his account of how color, the object of vision, is transmitted through the transparent media of air or water.
Vision occurs when the eye is affected. But since it is impossible that the actual color can come into contact with the eye, there must be a medium. If the space intervening between the eye and what is seen were actually a void, nothing would be seen at all. Color, then, sets the transparent medium, air, in motion. And since air occupies all of the space between the color and the eye, the movement of the air moves the eye.
Aristotle doesn't mean that the air and then the eye actually take on the color of the perceived object. He plainly doesn't mean that if we see a blue cup, that the air and then the inside of the eye turns blue. That would be pretty absurd. We can best understand Aristotle if we recall that any sensible form is a ratio of one extreme to another. In our example, blue is a ratio of black and white. But since air also has its extremes, so the change in the air is a ratio. This agitation in the air agitates the liquid in the eye, also in the same ratio. So the eye's agitation is caused by and embodies precisely the ratio of the color blue. So Aristotle says we receive in the sense organ the form without the matter. His account is philosophically significant, not because he describes the internal change in a sense organ. Instead, he explains how an object's sensible properties can cause a change in an animal, and how the animal picks out that object from its environment. Perception can be described as an organism's power to discriminate what it desires from the rest of its environment. This concept helps us to see why Aristotle thinks the soul is nothing more than the powers of a living body to perform various functions. Perception is just one of the powers of a living body. Although thinking and sensing are different processes, he assumes there are important similarities between the two.
If thinking is like perception, then it must be that the soul is acted upon by what is thinkable, or something similar. It is necessary, then, that this part of the soul be receptive to the form of an object. It must be potentially the same as the object, although not identical with it. Just as the sense organ is to the object of sense, so the mind is to the object of knowledge.
It's impossible to know exactly how Aristotle intended us to understand his famous claim that the mind, in his words, receives the form of the object. But this seems to be what he means. Whenever the mind grasps an abstraction, what Aristotle calls an intelligible form, it grasps as an abstraction the very same thing that is embodied in a physical object. When the mind grasps the concept of triangularity, it grasps the same principle embodied in triangles drawn on a blackboard. After all, we often say of someone who's not yet understood an abstraction, he doesn't have it yet. In Aristotle's obscure language, the soul of the person who doesn't yet understand only potentially possesses the intelligible form. After he grasps it, his soul actually possesses the intelligible form. Once a concept is grasped, we can explain what we've come to know. We can pick out examples of it from the environment. This is how Aristotle believes we acquire knowledge, when an intelligible form is received by the soul. But he specifically rejects the notion that the soul has a particular organ to receive intelligible forms.
It is not well reasoned to say that the mind is mixed with the body, for it would then have a qualitative property, being either cold or hot, for example. And the mind would have to have an organ by which it knows, as the power of sensation has an organ by which it perceives. But the mind has no such organ. It is rightly said, then, that the soul is the place of forms, except that the whole soul is not such a place, but only the soul's capacity for thinking.
Even though the soul doesn't have its own sense organ, we do need to use the various sense organs to acquire knowledge.
The soul is like a hand. But the hand is an instrument for using instruments, and the mind is a form for using forms, and sensation is a form which uses sensible forms. But since no form has a separate existence, what we know is in the sensible forms. It is on account of this, namely that we have sensation, that one can learn and understand anything. And so, whenever one would think theoretically, it is necessary that we think in terms of a mental picture. For mental pictures are like the things we perceive, except that mental pictures do not have the material component.
To understand this remark, let's remember Aristotle's view that all substances of the same natural kind have the same essence. All humans, for example, regardless of their different heights, hair colors, and so forth, share the same essential features that make them members of the same species. Fortunately, nature's provided us with a way to discover those features. We perceive different sensible forms and construct memories of them, what Aristotle calls mental pictures. We can compare these forms in our memory to eliminate the non-essential features and to identify what they have essentially in common. This common essence we grasp as an abstraction. We can't know this essence without comparing mental pictures, and we can't form mental pictures without perceiving the various sensible forms of objects. So we can't know without first perceiving a variety of objects. Only by perceiving things can we abstract the essence common to each. In this sense, then, the soul is like a hand which is an instrument which uses other instruments. The soul is an instrument for knowing, and it uses the sense organs as instruments for sensing. The main thrust of Aristotle's theory of the mind suggests that a man's knowledge and consciousness will perish when he dies. So Aristotle rejects Plato's notion that the soul continues to exist after death. Scholars have been surprised then to read in Aristotle's lectures that the rational soul, the part of the human soul capable of knowledge, may continue to exist after the death of the body. This idea would contradict his view that the soul is really nothing but the power of a living body to perform various functions. Aristotle said that the soul's relationship to the body is like an imprint on wax, but here he suggests that the soul may be separable from the body.
Since it is, in essence, activity, the rational part of the soul is separable, unaffected, and unmixed. For the agent is always more valuable than the thing acted upon, and this is the organizing principle of the body. When it is separated, this alone is the soul as it is, and this alone is deathless and immortal.
Scholars understandably have been perplexed by Aristotle's references to a separable, deathless, and immortal part of the human soul. The most likely explanation is that these passages in the lecture notes were written when Aristotle was a relatively young man, still under the influence of his teacher Plato. If the early editors of Aristotle's lectures had access to both his immature thoughts and his final thoughts, they would have almost certainly included both for posterity to sort through. However we explain these passages, Aristotle's predominant view of the human soul requires that it be but one aspect of a living human being. Most of his teaching implies that when a man perishes, as all earthly creatures must, his soul perishes too. As we shall see, Aristotle believed that only by acquiring knowledge can a human become like the divine, eternally engaged in thought. But a man's ability to imitate the divine lasts only for the brief time he lives. Aristotle's philosophy is systematic, that is, it integrates and connects several philosophical topics into one coherent whole. So we can't be surprised that his theory of the soul plays an integral role in his ethical theory. Modern ethical theorists tend to see ethics as a way to determine the rules of right conduct, but Aristotle thinks that ethics should provide the right account of eudaimonia, a term translators usually render into English as happiness. As we shall see, Aristotle's theory of the soul is crucial because he argues that mankind achieves the best by fully developing the potentials of the human soul. Aristotle wrote a number of treatises on ethics, but scholars generally agree that his most mature thinking on the subject is found in the Nicomachean Ethics. This work probably was named for his son, Nicomachus. In it, Aristotle begins his search for happiness by distinguishing between what we want for its own sake, ends in themselves, and what we want for the sake of something else, means to other ends. Aristotle then says that as long as we want something even partly for the sake of something else, there must be some supreme end. There must be something we want only for its own sake, and not for the sake of anything else.
Every art and every investigation, and likewise every action and choice, seems to aim at some good. It has been correctly said that the good is that at which all things aim. There are differences, however, among the ends pursued. Some are activities, whereas in other activities the ends are beyond the actions themselves. Whenever the ends are beyond the actions themselves, the end products are by nature superior to the activities themselves. If, therefore, there is an end of actions which we desire for its own sake, and we wish for other ends only for the sake of this one end, and if we do not choose everything for the sake of something else, it is clear that there must be some best good. Would not the knowledge of this be of great importance for the conduct of life? If this is so, we ought to determine what this supreme good is.
Aristotle reminds us that ethics differs in two fundamental ways from other branches of philosophy. First, some fields of inquiry, like metaphysics and natural science, are theoretical sciences. Knowledge gained in these areas is valuable for its own sake, but ethics, on the other hand, is a practical discipline. Whatever knowledge it provides is desirable for the sake of right action. Ethics also is different from the other branches of philosophy in that theoretical sciences are precise, but ethics is not. In theoretical discrepancies, we can logically deduce conclusions that are always true from premises which are also always true. But a practical discipline such as ethics affords us no such precision. Aristotle issues the following warning.
What we say about these matters will be sufficient if it achieves the accuracy which the subject matter allows. For one must not look for the same degree of exactness in all disciplines, any more than in all crafts. Therefore, in a discussion of such matters as those in ethics, one must be satisfied to reveal the truth in a rough outline. When the subject matter is something that holds true only as a general rule, the conclusions reached will be of the same order of exactness. For the educated person seeks the degree of exactness the nature of the subject matter allows.
To this warning, Aristotle issues two further caveats. First, all people will not benefit from ethics because their minds are already made up about what they want to pursue in life.
Argument and instruction are not persuasive for all people, but the soul of the student must be trained by habits to enjoy what is noble and to hate what is ignoble, just as the soil must be prepared for the seed. The person who lives by his passions will neither be turned around nor understand these arguments. But if so, how is it possible to change such a person?
Second, the young or the immature can't profit from lectures about ethics. Understanding them, Aristotle thinks, requires considerable experience with complex moral judgments.
Each person judges well that which he knows, and he is a good judge of such things. Thus, a good judge in each field is one who has been educated in it, and a good judge in general is one who has been well educated generally. Hence, the young student is not suitable for the study of politics. They are inexperienced in matters of living and arguments deriving from these experiences, and what concerns these experiences.
As with his lectures on other branches of philosophy, Aristotle thinks it's best to review first the most popular and accepted opinions regarding the good life. Even if we don't agree with them, such views probably contain some kernel of truth that'll help us search for happiness. Three concepts of happiness in particular, he thinks, merit discussion: the life of pleasure, the life of honor, and the life of contemplation.
Most people, as well as the cultured, say that happiness is to be understood as living well and doing well. But they disagree about what happiness is, and most people give a different account from the learned. Most people, and indeed the most vulgar people, think happiness is pleasure. Hence, they want the life of enjoyment. Most people then reveal themselves to be completely slavish, having chosen a life fit for cattle. But they seem reasonable because many people in high positions agree with their feelings. But people of refinement who lead lives of action think happiness is honor, for this is the goal of the life of politics. But honor seems to be too superficial to be the good we are seeking, for it seems to depend too much on those who do the honoring than on those who are honored, whereas we believe that the good life is something fitting for its possessor and hard to take away from him. The third life is the life of contemplation, which we shall consider in what follows.
Aristotle thinks we should test the three concepts of happiness against the most common views about the nature of the good life. He says that happiness should be both fitting for its possessor and, once acquired, hard to take from him. Later, he adds that in the good life, we get things we want for their own sake. In the good life, we get enough of them to make our lives self-sufficient. Listen to Aristotle define the notion of self-sufficiency.
We apply the term self-sufficient not to a person alone living an isolated life, but also to parents, children, wife, and generally to friends and fellow citizens, since man is by nature a political being. We take the self-sufficient to be that which makes a life worthy of being chosen, and lacking in nothing. And we think happiness is just that sort of thing. It is the most worthy of all goods, though not as one good among the others. Were that the case, it is clear that happiness would be more worthy of being chosen with the addition of even the least good. And among goods, the greater is always the more worthy of being chosen.
Someone's life is self-sufficient, then, if it can't be improved. Let's say that both pleasure and noble action are valuable in themselves. One man has a lot of pleasure in his life. Another has as much pleasure, but also performs noble actions. Aristotle would say the second man comes closer to attaining the ideal of happiness. After all, his life is more self-sufficient. It contains more things that are good in themselves. Aristotle's view that happiness consists of things good in themselves, that it is self-sufficient and hard to take away from whoever possesses it, may help us understand why pleasure or honor alone do not constitute the good life. But these attributes of happiness don't tell us what Aristotle thinks happiness is. To understand his concept of happiness, let's recall his doctrine that every natural substance embodies an essence which allows it to perform the characteristic functions of its species. Aristotle says a characteristic function of humanity is related to happiness.
Perhaps we will arrive at what constitutes happiness quickly by considering the proper function of man. Just as the eye, the hand, and the foot, and, in general, each of the parts have a function, is there not a function of man in addition to these parts? What would this be, then? Simply being alive is something man shares with plants. But we are seeking something unique to man. Thus, we must exclude simply growing and taking in nutrition. Then there is sense perception. But this is shared in common with the horse, the ox, and every animal. There remains, then, the active life of the part that possesses reason.
Of course, merely being rational doesn't make us happy. All humans are in some sense rational, but obviously not everyone leads the good life. We have to distinguish, then, between those who merely are rational and those who use their rational abilities properly.
If something is good because of its function, the attainment of excellence must be added to the function. Thus, the function of a harpist, for example, is to play the harp. The function of a good harpist is to play well. If this is so, and if the function of man is to live a certain kind of life, and if this is the activity of the soul issuing in actions performed in accordance with reason, and if a good man is one who performs the actions well and nobly, and if an activity is performed well, when it is performed in accordance with its proper virtue, then the good for man is the activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. And if there be more than one virtue of the soul, in accordance with the best and most complete. But this must be achieved over a complete lifetime. For one swallow does not make a spring, nor does one good day. Thus, neither does one day, nor a brief time, make a man blessed and happy.
This is the end of Side One. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.